Sam Henderson, it was what, over 10 years ago, maybe 15, that you decided that you wanted to find ways to slow down or reverse Alzheimer's.
That's correct, yeah. When my mom was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, I made that my new sort of scientific line of investigation.
The focus that you gave to this was different than most other researchers, though.
Yeah, you know, I looked at the current data that was out at the time, which was focused on, you know, A-beta and tau. And I looked at the stuff that was being done at the company I was working at the time, and, you know, it was too long-term for me. You know, my mom was diagnosed then, and all these other treatments were, you know, 5-10 years out. And so I thought we needed something sooner and faster.
And at that time, the focus was on trying to melt out the gummy tars in the brain with the thought that that would make Alzheimer's go away.
Yeah, that's still pretty much the focus. We've had several really big trials recently. There's one drug developed by Pfizer and Elan called bapineuzumab, which is a humanized antibody to the sticky plaques that accumulate in your brain. They've been having all sorts of trouble with that trial, unfortunately. What it is, it's an infused antibody. So you have to sit in the doctor's office and they infuse you with the antibody. You know, it binds to the protein and then clears it out of your blood. So unfortunately, some of the patients, particularly ones who carry the genetic risk factor for Alzheimer's disease, develop really bad cerebral edema. I mean, they get swelling in the brain. And so they've had to back off on the high dose in those patients.
You know, there's been a lot of thought among the researchers who think that melting the plaques is a bad idea. They've said those plaques may be Band-Aids to deal with the damage that's in there. And if you melt them out, you could get things like cerebral hemorrhages.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people questioning now the whole A-beta hypothesis for Alzheimer's disease. But I think the big bapineuzumab trial and Eli Lilly has another monoclonal antibody, and I think BMS, Bristol-Myers Squibb, has one as well. So I think once they do these trials, and if they really don't get any cognitive improvement, then that'll be a good piece of data to have to sort of move the field somewhere else, I think.
Well, and all this time you've been moving in a different direction from that idea of let's just melt those plaques in the brain. You've been thinking, what can we do to nourish the nerves so that they function better?
Right. The hypothesis that we work on is that there's this well-known problem that occurs in Alzheimer's disease in that your brain has difficulty metabolizing sugar. Sugar is the main source of energy for your brain.
Well, let's back up. Okay. Is it the main source of energy for the brain, or is it the one that most people in modern countries are habituated to using? Their brains are accustomed to using that as the main fuel.
Well, so your brain doesn't really use fats like most of the rest of your body does. So it pretty much wants to run on glucose all the time. But there's only one other fuel that it can really use efficiently, and that are all these ketone bodies. And as you mentioned, right, in modern Western society and diets very rich in carbohydrates, you almost never enter ketosis. You know, that's really considered a disease state almost.
Perhaps we could say that it's so unknown among most traditional healthcare practitioners, they're scared of it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That I gave a talk recently, and one of the physicians got up and said, you know, I try and spend most of my time trying to keep my patients out of ketosis. Now you're telling me to put them into ketosis. It doesn't make any sense. So there's been this very long bias in the medical literature against ketosis.
And if we look back at traditional cultures, there are a number of traditional cultures where their bodies were in ketosis most of the time because they didn't eat carbohydrates. You can probably name some of those cultures.
Yeah, absolutely. Like the Inuits, the farther north you go in latitude, the less plant matter and carbohydrates people eat in their diets. So like Inuits who live, you know, close to the North Pole, I mean, there's virtually no carbohydrate sources there to eat. So they eat almost entirely fat and protein.
And mostly fat.
Mostly fat, yeah.
The Plains Indians in what's now the United States, the warriors especially, really preferred to eat mostly fat and meat a little bit and as little of that putsy, wimpy carbohydrate food as they could.
Yeah, yeah. There's actually a really good book out called Good Calories, Bad Calories by Gary Taubes. You probably read it. So he points out in there that, you know, in the 1800s, it was very well known that carbohydrates made you fat. It was just like common knowledge. But then we went through this big shift where we went to vilify fats and sort of promote carbohydrates in people's diets. So now people eat, you know, 55, 60% of their caloric intake from carbohydrates, which is probably very evolutionarily discordant for most people practically everyone, that's not a good diet.
And so you've looked at the popular literature some on this. You know some of the history of how other people ate, but mostly you've looked at this as a scientist, and a scientist whose mom had this disease where you wish that she could have been healthier. And you look at other people and you wish they could be healthier. So you're interested in this stuff called ketones that the brain can use that's metabolized from fat and all of us can make. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so ketone bodies, you know, are sort of a natural part of your physiology. When you wake up in the morning, your ketone levels are slightly elevated because you fasted overnight.
Meaning you just didn't eat anything.
Right, right. So your blood glucose gets a little low, and so your body starts to burn its fat to make ketone bodies. This literature goes back to like the 1960s, where they did a really interesting experiment where they took a bunch of people, obese people, and they starved them. So they didn't eat anything for 5 weeks. Literally all they had was water and a vitamin and some salt. And in that paper, he shows that there's this huge spike of ketone bodies that occurs. And so he talks about, and particularly these ketone bodies are used to fuel your brain because your brain needs a lot of energy. And so interestingly, in this paper, he talks about, so your body can make glucose, can make sugar. So why doesn't it just make more sugar to fuel your brain instead of using these ketone bodies, which everyone thought were bad?
Let's slow down for just a second here and let people take that in, that our bodies, if we aren't eating anything, can choose to make either sugar from the tissue in our bodies,
right,
or it can make fat from the stored fats in our bodies and fats that our brain can use. In other words, if you stop eating, your body can make either one.
Right.
And you say that in this situation, it chooses to make which one?
It'll make the ketone bodies. And so he sort of explains in this paper why that occurs. So the major source for glucose or sugar to be made in your body are amino acids, proteins. So what happens is your body will start to break down its major source of proteins, which is your muscles. So you can imagine if you're starving and you start breaking down your muscles, this is very bad evolutionarily. Because yet you can't hunt, you can't gather, you can't find food if you're weak and tired. And your body doesn't really carry that much stored energy as protein. But, I mean, you can think about it. A typical person carries tens of thousands of calories around in fat.
Even if you're skinny?
Even if you're pretty skinny, yeah. And, you know, unfortunately in America, you know, with the obesity epidemic, there are people who have literally hundreds of thousands of calories that they're carrying around as fat.
Now, for some reason, they're locked out in their body. Their metabolism is locked out from reaching into that store of fat.
Right.
It's there, but they can't reach it. But if somebody stops eating, then it's there and it gets easier to reach.
Right. And so it makes a lot of sense if you think about it, because your body will then start to tap that very abundant source of energy to provide these ketone bodies, which can be used by lots of tissues in your body, particularly your brain. The thought I had over 10 years ago now was that if an Alzheimer's, you're having difficulty metabolizing glucose, maybe we can provide it with a ketone body, which is a normal fuel for your brain anyhow.
Well, if your body will make it if you just stop eating, why not just have Alzheimer's patients stop eating so they make their own ketones?
Well, you could do that, but, you know, it's probably not a good way to go, just, you know, obviously stop eating. You could also try these ketogenic diets, right, which are very high-fat, low-protein diets, low-carbohydrate as well, because remember that you'll make glucose from the protein. So in a true ketogenic diet, you eat very low amounts of protein as well. So you're basically eating very, very large amounts of fat.
Well, okay, so in a ketogenic diet, a person could eat that their whole lives. The Inuit, the Eskimo up in the Arctic Circle, this is how they lived. And this is how the Maasai warriors lived. And this is how the Plains Indians lived, on that kind of diet. It's not like it's a starvation diet. It's just a certain way to eat.
No, absolutely, yeah. There was actually just a paper that came out this year showing that a ketogenic diet improves cognitive performance in people with what's called mild cognitive impairment, which is thought to be a prodromal syndrome of Alzheimer's disease now.
What does prodromal mean?
A precursor syndrome. You're gonna start with MCI, and then you're gonna progress into Alzheimer's disease eventually. So, you know, I think the field is sort of coming around to this idea that ketone bodies are not a bad thing, and that, you know, it makes sense to provide your body with ketone bodies at a time. So, you know, these cultures that practice fasting, there's probably a reason they developed that, and that they knew, you know, intuitively that it was good for you. But, you know, having said all that, it's very difficult to fast. And it's very difficult to do a true ketogenic diet because carbohydrates are just everywhere.
Well, you say it's very difficult to fast, but Sam Henderson, you or I could just today go, okay, we're going to stop eating for a couple of days and see what happens. But then you're probably healthy enough to do that and feel a little tired and sleepy, but you could probably get everything else you want done. What about somebody who is frail and is already having trouble with their brain and they're struggling? What if you say to that person, let's just have you stop eating for a couple of days?
Yeah, that's probably not, I mean, once that disease state is set in, it's probably going to be very difficult to do that. Now, for example, in Alzheimer's disease, there's very well-known shift in food preference. So people with Alzheimer's disease tend to like very, very sweet foods. One hypothesis, right, is that that's the brain saying, look, you know, we're starving up here. We need some sugar. We need something to eat, you know, so quick, go out and get some Pop-Tarts or donuts or whatever. You know, an Alzheimer's patient to not eat or eat a ketogenic diet is going to be a big, big compliance challenge.
Meaning that they'll be suffering. They'll be unhappy.
They'll be very unhappy, yeah.
Well, is it like telling an addict who is addicted to cocaine or an alcoholic that, look, it's time to stop having cocaine or it's time to stop having alcohol? Could it be better just to stop?
Yeah, I mean, any of your listeners who've tried to do like an Atkins diet, because I've tried this over and over again, and you know that after a while of not eating carbohydrates, you know, after like a week, you really get that craving. You really want to go out and, you know, eat a donut. And I think you're right, there's like serotonin levels go up when you eat carbohydrates, so there's probably an addictive quality to it.
Well, you know, with quitting tobacco campaigns, they generally tell people that about 10 days into quitting, you're really going to miss it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I think that's very true of carbohydrates as well. You're definitely going to crave those.
All right, so you actually are setting up a scenario that one choice people could have is to get through that and get to the other side. We all know people who quit smoking and they don't crave cigarettes anymore. They just keep them away so that they don't have that start the craving again.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, once you get over that hump, that phase where you really, really want it, you're probably okay for the most part, unless you start falling off that wagon again, which is very, very easy to do in our society, I think, for dieting.
Yes, everyone knows that. And yet you are saying, despite the fact you have a product that provides ketones to people who have not switched into fat-burning mode, you're acknowledging that that could be one choice that people could make.
It's the preferred choice. I mean, if you can cut your carbohydrates down and do that for most of your life, you'll probably greatly reduce a lot of disease states. Type 2 diabetes, I think Alzheimer's, lots of other conditions. If you can really stick to that kind of diet, I mean, obviously I think that's the way to go.
Just from a philosophical and a nutritional standpoint, that's what you say. But at the same time, you suspect a lot of people would rather have their cake and their ketone bodies too.
Yeah, exactly right. That's the ideal condition you would want. Eat anything you want, and but not develop those disease states. I think that's where everyone would want to go.
Well, and given the fact that a lot of people have such trouble making the shift away from carbohydrates when the carbohydrates are harming them, that's where you thought of your product to give people a way to take in ketone bodies without adapting their body to making them themselves.
It's very difficult to restrict carbohydrates, so could we find a ingredient or a compound that you could take that would induce ketosis while you were still eating carbohydrates and things in your diet? So that was sort of the genesis of the idea. And so what we use are these things called medium-chain triglycerides, which are fats that are very different from traditional long-chain triglyceride fats.
Is that like fish oil?
Fish oil is a long-chain triglyceride, but a long-chain triglyceride is basically any triglyceride that contains fatty acid chains over 14 carbons. So basically it means like almost every fat that you eat is a long-chain triglyceride.
Okay. Is butter a long-chain triglyceride?
Yes.
Is the fat in meat a long-chain triglyceride?
Yes.
Is olive oil a long-chain triglyceride?
Yes.
Is fish oil a long-chain triglyceride?
Yes.
Okay. So it's just anything that tastes fatty, that's what it is.
Yeah. Almost 98% of the fat you take in your diet will be a long-chain triglyceride. The medium-chain triglycerides are fairly hard to come by in pure form.
You know, someone once told me that a medium or short chain triglyceride tastes like vinegar. What does it taste like?
If it's a pure triglyceride and there's no free fatty acids in it, it has no taste. It's odorless, tasteless, colorless, liquid.
Does it have a mouthfeel of fat?
Yeah, it's got kind of a slippery oil-like feel to it.
Do you have someone here in your office that is tasteable? Could anybody taste this? Could I go buy it at a pharmacy or at Walmart?
You can get it from, you know, some specialty nutrition places online, things like that. It's not that hard to find.
Is it a stable product?
Oh, yeah, they're very stable, yeah. Since they're fully saturated fats, they do not get oxidized readily at all, so they're very, very stable.
Well, what made you think that this would be a good line of product to start making for the sake of people with Alzheimer's who don't want to give up carbs? What is your thinking on how it could help them?
So the thought was that since their brains are having difficulty metabolizing sugar, glucose, is there another fuel that we can give them that maybe they'll be able to metabolize easier and more efficiently? So that fuel is what are called these ketone bodies. The idea is that when you take in these medium-chain triglycerides, what happens is your body will oxidize those or metabolize those regardless of your metabolic state. So, for example, you can take in MCTs with a large amount of carbohydrate, and your body will still metabolize those medium-chain fatty acids to produce ketone bodies.
I'm envisioning something where somebody takes in this product that makes it easier to make ketones, and their body just pours it out again. It just comes out in the urine, it comes out in the feces, and it never gets processed. Do you have evidence that shows that the body will gladly take this in and use it for energy?
There are a bunch of studies that demonstrate this where they take normal, healthy people and infuse them with ketone bodies and then follow their metabolism through the body. And you can see when people do this, there's several good studies from in the 90s where they show that when you infuse people with one particular ketone called beta-hydroxybutyrate, you can see a big increase in that uptake of that compound into the brain and metabolism of that compound in the brain with a concomitant reduction in glucose metabolism in the brain. So this paper very clearly shows that when you elevate ketones in circulation in your body, your brain sort of switches over to metabolizing the ketones instead of the glucose.
Now that's an interesting study because you're not describing something where these people were starving or they were on a fast. Instead, they just got this special nutrient and the brain went, yahoo, this is what we'd rather have.
The benefits of the ketone bodies is very easily metabolized. It's only a 4-carbon molecule, so it can very readily be metabolized and enter the citric acid cycle in your mitochondria. Unlike glucose, which is a fairly large molecule and has to go through the steps of glycolysis to be broken down.
There's this little engine in your cells called the mitochondria, and it's a few steps for glucose, sugars to be metabolized and burned inside that mitochondria or anywhere in a cell. But oil, it just kind of slips right in, and the mitochondria has a very easy time turning that into energy.
Right. There are only 3 steps before it becomes acetyl-CoA compared to glucose, which is, I think, 12. So it's much easier on your body. That's one way to look at it. It's much easier for your body to metabolize it than it is for a molecule of glucose.
And that's why the brain might like it better?
Yeah. I mean, it's a very efficient fuel because it's basically ready to go sort of molecule for the mitochondria.
In a healthy person, does it reduce their cravings for sugar?
There's been a bunch of studies looking at MCTs for things like satiety and weight loss. And some of them show that it will reduce your desire to eat food. But I mean, the caveat with these studies is that so MCTs are a little difficult to digest.
The medium-chain triglycerides?
Right. So when you take them in, there tends to be some, especially if you take a large amount, there tends to be some diarrhea and nausea and things like that from the rapid metabolism of the MCT.
Oh, so your bloodstream likes it as a fuel inside the bloodstream to give to cells, but the digestive tract, just as a liquid to be taking in, is a little challenged by how to process it.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you take like the straight oil, it can be quite hard on. It's just imagine drinking any sort of straight oil. Be a little hard to digest. So, you know, we spend a lot of time, you know, formulating it to making it easier to digest, and we titrate people on the dose to get them acclimated to the fairly large dose that we give them.
Would it make a good salad dressing?
I don't know. I've never tried that.
Well, I'm wondering because that would give some roughage to eat with the oils so that it might slow down the digestion just enough to let the digestion take it in more.
We typically recommend people take it with another sort of fatty fat source, because what you're really trying to do is give another fat to compete out the lipases that break down the MCT, so you don't have quite as rapid a digestion of the MCT.
Okay, so lipase is a digestive enzyme in the gut and the stomach, somewhere in there?
Yeah, it's in there, mostly in your small intestine, yeah.
Is it in the duodenum?
Yes.
Okay, so it's in the little pouch that's just below the stomach, and it breaks down fatty acids to their very simplest form, which is more like a vinegary kind of stuff. But you would rather have these medium-chain triglycerides be undigested when they hit the bloodstream.
Yeah, so what happens is the lipases attack the triglyceride and cut off the fatty acids. And then for a medium-chain fat, what are called medium-chain fatty acids, these little fats then go directly via the portal vein to your liver, which is a very different pathway than a long-chain fatty acid would take.
Well, okay, so that the medium and short-chain fatty acids, this is kind of geeky, but let's go ahead and explain it, that the big complicated ones like the butters and the olive oils, they go into these kind of balls of fat that go into your lymph system.
That's correct, right? So when you go to McDonald's or wherever and you eat a Big Mac that's full of long-chain triglycerides and you eat some carbohydrate with it, well, even if you don't eat, it doesn't matter if you have carbohydrate or not. What will happen is that long-chain triglyceride will, the lipases will attack that. They'll cut off the fatty acids off that. Then the cells in your gut will then reassemble it back again as a triglyceride and then take that and make it into this big, like you said, balls, these big lipoprotein particles, and then dump them into your lymph system, which then enters in your neck and enters into circulation.
So it just kind of floats along, kind of drifts through the lymph system, drift, 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 up until the vein in your neck, and then it goes whoosh into your heart and on from there.
Right. So these lipoprotein particles people know as LDL and HDL.
Then these big things called chylomicrons.
Right. So what you don't want are these LDL particles floating around your bloodstream, these big lipoprotein particles, because that means you're not breaking down the fats. What you want are the HDLs, the good cholesterol, people call it, which are basically the fat-depleted versions of these lipoprotein particles.
And so this is a long and detailed explanation of why there's some thought that goes into what kind of fat you want people to eat, because you want to have a fat that kind of slips by this slow barge-like system of the lymph system and goes, it's small enough that the body goes, oh, we can just send this right to the liver.
Right, right. So when a medium chain triglyceride gets cleaved, those little medium chain fatty acids are very soluble and they're small, so they don't get re-esterified and reassembled back in the triglycerides and don't get assembled into these lipoprotein particles. Instead, the medium chain fatty acids go directly to the portal vein, straight to the liver. And once they get to the liver, they're not re-esterified. The liver just says, oh, okay, here's some medium chain fatty acids. We're just going to oxidize it. We're just going to start metabolizing it regardless of anything in the diet. We're just going to burn it.
It says, oh, great. Here's some of those good old medium chain triglycerides. We don't have to do anything to them. Let's just send them right on because the body needs them.
Right. It's going to be break them down no matter what.
All right. Well, and so your thought about eating a little bit of other kind of fat with your formulation is so that the lipases go after that and leave the medium chain, that's hard to say. The medium, that's why you say MCT, I'll bet.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. The MCTs, just like they are, because that's the best way for the body to use them.
The medium chain triglycerides are metabolized very efficiently. So those medium chain fatty acids are cut off very quickly. So when you take in a large amount of the MCTs, you can get this large amount of medium-chain fatty acids in your duodenum and your small intestine, which can be, for some people, hard to tolerate. So if you can slow that digestion down a little bit, then you can reduce the sort of adverse events you see with the MCTs. So, you know, in our formulation, we mix in some long-chain triglycerides, and we recommend people take it with a meal. Usually, and it's better if they take it with, you know, a fatty meal, a little bit of cheese maybe, or something that can slow the digestion down a little bit.
And so, in a way, it might be good to be adapted to a higher-fat diet anyway, if you're taking in this product.
Oh, definitely, yeah. And, people have known for a long time on these ketogenic diets that they give to kids that if you sort of slowly titrate people up on both normal fats and medium-chain triglycerides, that they can tolerate very high amounts over time. So you're right, there definitely is an adaptation that occurs over time.
Now, what is the benefit of this to someone with Alzheimer's? If you give them this product, or if they just adapt to a high-fat diet over time, what happens to their cognition? What happens to their food cravings?
We've done two clinical studies with our product in people with mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. And the outcomes we measure are change in cognition. We use a test that's called the ADAS-Cog test, which is a test of a variety of measures of cognition, and in particular, short-term memory, which people know is one of the first things that's affected in Alzheimer's disease. So in our first study that we published in 2004, you can see actually a very rapid change in improvement in cognition when people take the MCTs.
How long did that improvement in cognition last?
Well, I mean, the way the study was done was they were given us one dose of the MCTs, and then their cognition was tested 90 minutes later. And we could see an improvement in cognition in 90 minutes. But we didn't measure any time points after that.
Do you have some clients, or are there some patients who've been on your product long enough for there to be any measurements of what happens to their cognition over time?
So we did another study where we posted in 2009, where we looked at people who were on the product for 90 days. And we saw improvement both at days 45 and day 90 in a particularly genetic subpopulation of the subjects. So we can see, the long-term benefit, at least for 90 days.
Well, if it was my grandmother or my aunt, I'd like to see it work for 9 years.
We would have to do that study, which would be a very difficult long-term study. So now, our next study we're setting up is for 6 months. So we'll get another longer data point. To do these very long-term longitudinal studies is very challenging, especially for a small company like us.
Are you getting any help from the National Institutes of Health or any groups that are concerned about Alzheimer's?
We have not gotten any grants from National Institutes of Health.
What other conditions do you think this might potentially help to have somebody be on a higher fat diet and also, or just on more of these medium chain triglycerides?
Well, if you look in the literature, there was an experiment done a couple years ago in Parkinson's disease where they tried a ketogenic diet in Parkinson's disease, and they noted some improvements in measures of movement and things in Parkinson's disease. There's some suggestion in the literature for some other conditions like epilepsy, obviously, which has been known for a long time that people with pediatric epilepsy, especially if they're non-responders to the current therapies, when they're put on these ketogenic diets, they see very strong reduction in seizure frequencies. So those are the two ones that I think have a good probability of success.
Well, I'm thinking now that a lot of these that we're talking about are nerve diseases that involve nerve systems, or brain is nerve, and so systems that are damaged that have nerves in them. So could we put possibly multiple sclerosis in there, muscular dystrophy, possibly Lou Gehrig's disease? Anything that has a nerve damage component to it, people with brain injuries.
We haven't studied it in any of those conditions, so we really can't make any sort of off-label claims to any of those conditions.
But what about as a scientist, as you look at just how nerves function and how metabolism functions, what's your guess?
There's a good reason to suspect that ketone bodies may be advantageous in numerous sort of neurological conditions, mostly because, the neurons will sort of constitutively metabolize glucose. So this is why you see a lot of neural problems in people with diabetes, because their blood glucose gets too high, and they generate lots of what are these called reactive oxygen species when they metabolize glucose. So ketomides may be beneficial in a lot of those sort of neurological conditions, but we haven't studied that, so we can't really make any claims to that.
You can't make any official claims, which makes me think that you have gotten approval to make claims about some diseases. What has the FDA approved your product for?
So our product is a medical food, so there's no official approval from the FDA. So for a medical food, you just basically have to do studies. You have to demonstrate that it actually works in clinical studies. You need two adequate and well-controlled studies. And then it has to be backed up by scientific evidence, then you can actually make a disease claim. Like our label claim is for the metabolic processes associated with mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. So we can make a disease claim. And right now it's mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease because that's what we studied in our two studies.
Okay, so you can make that claim because you have two peer-reviewed studies that have been published in scientific journals. And that's the certificate.
Right, for medical food, that's what's required, yeah.
Now, if I wanted to get this product, where could I go to get it?
The medical foods have to be administered under medical supervision. And so that means for our product, you need a prescription. So you have to go to your doctor and have them write you a prescription. Then you go to your pharmacy, and you can get it at any pharmacy in the U.S., Walmart, Costco, Rite Aid, Walgreens.
Is it expensive?
It retails for about $80 to $90 a month.
Is that like for the size of a bottle of olive oil or what?
No, it comes as a powder that you mix up. You get a 30-day box, which is a fairly large box, which contains 30 little pouches or packets, and then you mix that with water or juice or milk or whatever you want.
Okay, I'm picturing that it's oil that's been suffused with some kind of coating that dissolves in water and then lets the oil be out, and there you have it.
Yeah, so we use a matrix to encapsulate the oil, which is quite similar to the matrix that's used in ice cream. So it's sort of a protein maltodextrin matrix, which is very stable and creates a very stable emulsion, which helps digestion and relieves some of those adverse events. Then you can mix that product in whatever you want. And we have people who mix it with, you know, puddings and soft foods, which people seem to like. I kind of like it in orange juice because it has sort of like a orange Julius type flavor to it when you do that.
All right. Well, so there's those ways that you can take it in. But what if somebody is... it appeals to them, the logic of eating a higher fat diet and a lower carbohydrate diet, you wouldn't want to mix it in orange juice then.
Right. If you're trying to cut out your carbohydrates, you can just mix it in water. It's vanilla flavored, so it's pretty good in water alone.
And it doesn't have enough carbs in it to pop somebody out of ketosis on their own.
No, I think that has 2 grams of sugar in it.
What size of serving?
That's a 40-gram serving.
So one time a day, you would add 2 grams of sugar to your total load of sugars.
Right, which is pretty low.
If a person could inform their doctor about this product and their interest in it, they could use it for anything they're curious about, actually.
I guess if you could get your doctor to write the script for it, yeah.
Doctors write scripts for a lot of off-label uses. I'm wondering if somebody was curious about this, where it would be potentially the most helpful. And there are a number of studies that say if somebody's switching to fat burning or they're going to do a fast, the first 24 hours is the toughest part. After someone gets through 48 hours, there's some metabolic shifts that tend to happen where it's a smoother process. But for some people, that first 24 hours is really uncomfortable and might even be stressful on their body.
Yeah, you know, I've done those sort of at-home experiments where you try and drive yourself into ketosis as quick as possible. So usually if you read around the internet, and like bodybuilders tend to do this a lot. So if you exercise very vigorously on that day you quit the carbohydrates, you can deplete your glycogen stores, and that'll push you into ketosis much more quickly. Or you can, you know, drink some Exona, which will push you into ketosis within 20 minutes.
Does that feel different? I mean, once you're in ketosis, can you feel it, or is it just kind of a subtle thing? If you're taking in ketones is the way to do it.
We haven't had any reports of people feeling any differently once they're on, other than improve cognition and in an Alzheimer's patient.
How about somebody who has trouble shifting to an Atkins-style diet and they just always hit a huge hurdle? Could it be like the Nicorette of switching to fat burning to take in this kind of medium chain triglyceride?
Yeah, I guess you could think of it that way if they're trying to acclimate themselves into being in ketosis.
And we're talking theoretically. Nobody, as you know, has tried this actually.
Not that I know of, no.
Last question is that in a true fat-burning mode, there's other things that happen besides having ketone bodies. For instance, insulin levels go down, leptin levels go down, the cells become more sensitive to the signaling of a lot of hormones. If somebody's taking in carbs, that's not going to happen. So are there some benefits that could be lost if somebody just takes in this kind of product and keeps eating ice cream and cookies and sodas?
Yeah, if you keep eating carbohydrates in your diet, you're not going to lose weight, obviously, because you're stimulating your insulin signaling, which is a fat storage protein, hormone, which is going to stimulate the storage of fat. So, you know, the studies that have looked at MCTs for weight loss mostly focus on this satiety thing, that once you take the MCTs, you don't really feel hungry anymore. I mean, that's probably due to sort of that queasy feeling that you get in your stomach and you just don't want to eat. And also, I think, people who have been on, an Atkins diet knows that, people self-limit their caloric intake when they're on that kind of diet. Because, I've done this many times, but, after a while, eggs and ham and tuna and steak is just like, blah, I don't want to eat that anymore. So people just limit their calories naturally without having to consciously do it.
Well, there's another theory of that. I mean, you get bored with that kind of diet is what you're saying.
Yeah.
One could argue that maybe you need a better chef who can make it more varied for you.
That's probably true. I'm a terrible chef, so I always have a hard time sticking on it.
The other side of it is that it may not just be the boredom of food that changes somebody's attitude toward the food. It may be that appetite signals, as hormones become more sensitive, go down so that a person isn't just bored with their food. Their body is telling them accurately, you've had enough food. You don't need more food. And we know that because our energy metabolism signaling is more clear now. It's not as gummed up and muddied by having insulin and leptin and all kinds of other hormone signals be way too high. So the body's operating more intelligently.
I think that's absolutely right because, fat is one of the main satiety signals to your body. When you're taking a lot of fat and that's all you're eating, your body's saying, you're right, absolutely right. You're saying, oh, I've had enough. I don't want to eat anymore.
And it's partly a satiety signal for your stomach getting that kind of nutrient, but metabolically inside, once it's in the bloodstream, your body doesn't really want to be fat. It wants to have enough fat, but it doesn't need to be super fat. And your body knows that if the signaling is accurate for it.
I personally think your body wants to be fat because what your body wants to do is store fat for when you run out of food later.
Yeah, I've always wondered about that argument because, there's a lot of debate about that. But why is it that people, when they're older, past the reproductive years, are when they're most likely to be fat? And people, when they're really young, is not when they're likely to be fat. I mean, our temperatures don't go up every year just because we're getting older.
Well, I think, when you're younger, you're competing for mates. So you tend not to want to be fat. But, you look at the obesity epidemic now, and kids and high school kids, they're pretty fat. And I think, the big issue is, it's this thrifty genotype hypothesis that Neil came up with in the 60s. That sort of you want to store fat for when you're going to run out of food. Because for most of human evolution, people probably ran out of food fairly regularly. So they want to store fat as readily as they can. And so when you take in all these carbohydrates, that's what your body does. It says, oh, let's just store fat. Let's just get fat because we're going to run out of food next week and we're going to need all this fat. So I think that, to me, that's the fundamental shift that occurred in human diets. Right? As soon as we found this very abundant source of carbohydrates in terms of grains, then people could get as fat as they wanted easily. Whereas in the past, it was probably fairly difficult for them to find that sort of carbohydrate-rich food all the time.
Yeah, well, maybe there's some truth to that, or maybe the thrifty gene hypothesis is fundamentally wrong. Who knows? But when we get back to your product and the idea of what people need when they're sick, and especially with a neurological disease, there may be reasons to have them try out a way to pull back on carbohydrates, find ways to nourish their system with foods that make it easier to shift into making ketone bodies. And this may be kinder to their appetites. They might not be tortured by carbohydrates the way they are when their body really is starving because that whole system has gotten so messed up. Every sugar that they eat doesn't really get to their cells as energy right.
The idea of shifting to a low-carbohydrate diet has lots of benefits, not only weight loss and neurological conditions, but probably other things as well.
Theoretically, what do you think about this kind of product, the medium-chain triglycerides, for serious illnesses? Somebody who is at a very dire strait in terms of a neurological disease, would there be any harm for them trying this kind of product as a way to see if their damaged nerve cells might get a little more nourishment and might be destructed more slowly?
Well, that's one of the benefits of using this. It's already in a GRAS-approved food additive. So what GRAS is a generally recognized as safe by the FDA, which is a much higher standard of safety than any drug. right? Like most drugs I wouldn't want to take because of, you know, side effects. But so food additives and these grass substances have to be reviewed by the FDA as to whether or not they're safe for human consumption. And so since it is a food ingredient, you know, it's pretty safe other than some GI upset you can get when taking large doses of it.
Okay. Well, thank you. So you think that this product might help people who just might help them with cognitive impairment. There's some studies that you've done that have shown that if they have Alzheimer's, you think it has some potential for some other nerve diseases that haven't been officially studied. And you think that it might not hurt somebody to try it if they're curious about this, even with a serious condition, or if they just have cravings and they want to see what happens to their cravings if they get more ketone bodies into their bodies earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I think it, you know, if you look at the literature on ketosis, especially in the last couple of years, you can see a lot of potential applications, yeah.
Sam Henderson, it's not just people that you've studied this product in. You've also looked at it in some animals, such as dogs. What happened when you used it in dogs, and how did you use it?
We did a few studies in dogs to look at a couple things. One is cognition in the dogs, in older dogs. The dogs suffer from a Alzheimer's-like syndrome called canine cognitive decline. And so if anyone has an old dog, they probably know these sort of symptoms of that. Sort of a bit of a wandering, less human interaction, less like a puppy, less like a young dog. So we supplemented their diets with the MCTs, and we noted improvements in several measures of both canine cognition and motor control. So they were able to do tasks better, motor tasks better, and their cognition was better. And that study was actually replicated by a scientist at Purina, so it's been independently validated.
What does motor cognition mean?
It was a motor task. So what they did was they had to reach their paw out and grab a little treat and pull it towards them. And so the dogs who were given the MCTs could do that task better than they could the dogs who were given the placebo. So their motor skills improved. And these are older animals. And so we also looked at how their mitochondria were functioning in their brain.
That's that little engine that is the furnace inside of cells that helps our whole body get energy, the mitochondria.
Right. So we knew that, you know, ketone bodies act mainly in the mitochondria. So we looked to see if this induction of ketosis could improve the function of these mitochondria in the brains of the dogs. And you can see a big improvement in their respiration rate. So they were able to more efficiently utilize the fuels that they were given.
Meaning that they didn't have to work as hard to breathe.
Yeah, they could generate more energy using less oxygen, so they were much more efficient. And so the other thing we looked at was the composition of lipids in their fats in their brain. The reason we sort of did that was the Dr. Taha that wanted to do this study was he had worked on these ketogenic diets, and he knew from these previous studies that when you put kids on these ketogenic diets...
You mean children with epilepsy, for instance?
Right.
This is, by the way, is that ketogenic diet for epilepsy has been tested out at Johns Hopkins especially, and it is one of the most, maybe more effective than most drugs in terms of eliminating or reducing epileptic seizures.
Yeah, absolutely. There's probably 50 years of research on that, and it's a very effective treatment. So in this study that Dr. Taha had looked at previously was he found that when you put these kids on these ketogenic diets, their blood levels of these omega-3 fatty acids goes way up. Even if you don't supplement the diet with things like DHA and EPA, the blood levels go way up. And the idea being that when you stimulate fatty acid oxidation, your body then releases these polyunsaturated fatty acids, these PUFAs, which are really good for you, as everyone has heard about, you know, the benefits of fish oil and things like that. So he wanted to see is if you trick the animal into thinking it's in ketosis, does this same thing happen?
And when you said trick the animal, this is not like hiding a treat and saying, my beloved dog, I'm going to try to trick you. This is fooling their body cells into doing something, and not just the dog's behavior, right inside of their trillions of cells.
Right, right. Instead of putting them on a ketogenic diet, we just gave them the MCTs so that their liver would make ketones out of that. Instead of the liver being in a carbohydrate and protein restricted environment where it would make ketones. So that's sort of the trick. So when we did that, then we measured various lipid levels in their brain. And you can see a big change in the lipid environment in the brain of these old dogs. So, you know, people think fat is bad, but your brain is like mostly fat. is a very large amount of fat. And as you age, the cholesterol levels and your fat levels in your brain go down. And this is bad, right? And these are also sort of things that happens in MS. You sort of get this depletion of fatty acids in your brain.
And in a lot of other neurological diseases, Parkinson's.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So it was interesting. So what we found was that, you know, the total lipid content of the brain went up. And you could see specifically increases in those omega-3 fatty acids in the brain, like DHA and EPA, which are used in the composition of the lipid membranes in the cells in your brain.
Now, you don't know whether that's because those nutrients were supplied in greater amount or that the body, once it wasn't burning inefficiently, was able to save those kind of fatty acids and use them more effectively as building materials. It could be that it already had these materials there, but it used them in a better way once it was a cleaner metabolism.
Right. His hypothesis was that, you know, once the body is in this fat-burning mode, once you switch it over either by, you know, dietary means or giving it an MCT, then your body will then start to release all of these polyunsaturated fatty acids, these omega-3s and these omega-6s, which then enter the brain and can be used to rebuild the lipid membranes in your brain. It was a really interesting study that we did, and we published that in 2009, I think.
Well, Sam Henderson, this makes me very curious about all the different ways this kind of product might be used. I know that you only have one FDA-approved official medical use for this product, which is the Alzheimer's disease. But I can't help it. I'm thinking of all kinds of ways that I might like to use this and try it out and experiment with it if I had all kinds of different diseases. You don't mind if I just express that wish, do you?
No, but keep in mind, right, that medical foods are not approved by the FDA. So there's sort of just sort of a, they look at it and if it, they think it meets the thing, but they don't ever issue an approval letter for a medical food.
But I can claim an interest in the possibility that this kind of food might help people with a lot of different conditions, that it's intriguing that it might. I can say that. Can you say that?
No, I really can't say that.
Well, why not? I mean, you're a scientist. You can talk about the theory of these things. Why can't you say that with all that you know? I mean, it's obvious to me that this has some potential. Why can't you say that too?
Well, you know, since we're selling a product, and you know, we've done, I think, you know, to our credit, we've actually done studies to demonstrate that this product works in Alzheimer's disease. And, you know, for us to speculate that it would work in MS or PD or whatever without actually having doing the studies would be, you know, a little bit irresponsible on our part. You know, we really need to do those studies to then make those claims.
All right. So I can say as a person asking you questions, boy, it seems like common sense that this might be a potential mechanism that might help somebody with Parkinson's disease or somebody with MS or somebody with another neurological condition. It might be something that might be worth looking into. I could say that. I could be curious about that. But because you're selling a product, you really can't say that?
Yeah, that's correct.